So just out of curiosity, we started a new sermon series last week called God's Grand Story. I sent out an email to the congregation challenging you to read all of Genesis and all of Job this week in preparation for this sermon. Just out of curiosity, how many of you attempted that? I'm impressed. Okay, how many of you succeeded? One, two, three, four, five, six. Huh?
This morning.
This morning. Yeah, that counts. So some of you may remember that a few years ago, I got all enamored with the television program Lost. You remember that? Okay, and I got somebody, I told somebody about that, and they said, what a lousy TV show. I said, oh, may God have mercy on your sin-sick soul. One of the reasons I really like that is because as the story unfolded, there was a backstory to each of the characters. And in fact, there was even a backstory to the island. And as you learned the backstory of the different characters and you learned the backstory of the island, the current story got even more filled out and important, and you had a different view than you would have had if you didn't have the backstory. So today we're going to start looking at the backstory of the Jesus story. And that backstory is found in the Old Testament. And it covers the big arc of God's grand story, which is creation, fall, redemption. And this morning we're going to talk about Genesis and Job and the backstory of good and evil. Genesis 1 starts out this way. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And he separated the light from the darkness, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. There was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, let there be a vault between the waters to separate water from water. So God made the vault and separated the water under the vault from the water above it, and it was so. And God called the vault sky, and there was evening, and there was morning, the second day. And God said, let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, and let dry ground appear. And it was so. And God called the dry ground land, and the gathered waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. So the text goes on to recount the rest of creation. In fact, it does it through two creation stories. And it's clear as you read them that these are not eyewitness accounts of what's happening. And they're not intended to be scientific accounts of what is happening. So when we take the Bible and try and make it into some kind of scientific historical explanation of what actually happened, we're actually doing violence to the text. They are a poetic telling of the story of the relationship between the Creator and His creation, and between human beings and each other, and between human beings and the earth. These are stories that were passed down from generation to generation and then written down somewhere around 400, 500 BC, about the time of the exile. When people were asking the question about the meaning of life, well, I thought we were God's chosen people, and here we are carted off into Babylon. Why do bad things happen to good people? What is the meaning of life? Where does it all come from, and where is it going? Now, when I say those kinds of questions that they're asking, you have to understand that those are exactly the same kinds of questions that people today are asking. Why do bad things happen to good people? Who am I? Where did I come from? Where am I going? I mean, when we deal with the stuff of life, and I look around here and I could begin to name some of the stuff that you guys are dealing with. And you ask the question, what is this all about? Is there any meaning? And where is God in the midst of all of this? Those questions, which are perennial questions, are the kinds of questions that are being addressed in the book of Genesis, but also in the book of Job. The first creation story is about God turning chaos into order and creating man and woman as the pinnacle of creation, and then God resting on the seventh day. Now, part of what we need to do is read ourselves into the story. I dare say that there are people here this morning who feel like their life is in chaos, and you ask the question, can God create order out of my chaos? So we read the scriptures, and hopefully what we get is the message, yes, he can. He's done it before, he'll do it again. He did it then, but he did it repeatedly, time and time and time again. The second story deals with the creation of man, and then the creation of nature, and finally the creation of woman. But the two stories, which are very, very different, actually tell two separate messages, all rolled up into one, which is that everything that was created by God, belongs to God. God is involved. He's not the same as creation. And that everything that God created is good. Well, if God, everything that God created was good, then why are things so bad? These three stories at the beginning of Genesis try to address that reason, the reason for that. Part of what these stories are telling us is that everything is grace. All is a gift, and all of it comes from God. Embedded in the first story at the end is that after God works, he takes a break. The first story tells us that you and I, human beings, men and women, are all created in God's image. And then the justification for the Sabbath day is given because God took a break, we're to take a break. When you and I work day in and day out, nonstop, when we don't take a Sabbath rest, what we're basically saying is we want to be better than God. In fact, this thing won't keep going. Nothing will keep going. My job won't keep going. My business won't keep going. My family won't keep going. Nothing will keep going unless I keep working. Apparently, God didn't feel that way about his creation. So part of the way we read ourselves into the story is to listen to that kind of stuff. And say, what is God saying to us? Not just back then, but for us now. Second story focuses on man and woman, men and women, and the relationship between men and women. Those of you who have husbands that went to the men's retreat, you need to ask them, well, what did Bill say about the relationship between men and women in chapter 2 of Genesis? And guys, you better be able to answer that. And ladies, if they can't answer it, send them to me and I'll tutor them once again. But the main thing is that both men and women are created, connected to the earth, but also connected to God. And so when we seek to understand ourselves, if we somehow want to disconnect ourselves from the earth, we're making a mistake because we are formed out of the earth. We're connected to the earth. But if we also want to understand ourselves apart from God, we make a mistake because God breathes the breath of life into human beings. And so there is something very earthy and very heavenly about every person. And the picture that is given, especially in Genesis chapter 2, is that God walks in the garden that he's placed the man and the woman with, and he has conversation with them. The image that is given is actually one of friendship. God has created us not out of some need for himself, but he's created us in order to be friends with him. So I look here and I look out in this congregation and I look at people who are my friends. I'll pick on Jack Risley. Jack Risley's a friend of mine. Okay, why is he my friend? Paul Philetus, he's also a friend of mine. Why is Paul a friend of mine? Because we agree on everything? No, actually we don't. But there is an affinity between us, and there is a certain level of intimacy and trust and care that exists between us. That's what friends do. God wants that kind of intimacy with us. He wants to have that kind of relationship with us. He doesn't want us to just have a list of things that we believe about Him. What He wants is relationship. He's created us for relationship, intimacy and closeness and trust and caring. The garden symbolizes what life is meant to be like, where we walk with God and live with God in that garden, in that beautiful place in which all things are presented to us by grace. And yet we know that our own experience is that we don't live in that garden. Well, why is that? We're off in exile. Whether we're in the exile of Babylon or we're in the exile of our own lives, we're in the exile of depression, or we're in the exile of a broken family, or we're in the exile of illness, where things don't work right in our bodies. Well, why is that? I thought everything was paradise. And that brings us to the third of the trinity of these beginning stories, which we call the fall. Bible doesn't, but that's what we call it. In this story, as Christy talked about in the children's message, we find out that there was freedom in the garden, but freedom within limits. And the limits were broken, and because of that broken breaking that limit, we have broken relationships. And what the Bible begins to tell is the broken relationship that happens between us and God, between us and ourselves, between us and each other, between us and the world, and between us and the earth. And all that which is intended to be paradise, we're excluded from, we're thrown out of the garden. See, that's part of our backstory, but I would say that's also part of our current story. We all want to be like God. We don't want limits. And we resist it when limits are given to us. We don't want the God that is. We want a different kind of God. We don't really want to be made in God's image. Because God is self-giving and loving and abundant, and He extends Himself for us where we are constantly grasping. Interesting to watch the kids come by each of the trunks last night, and how, especially the younger ones, they wanted to grab the whole bucket of candy. The older ones had learned, well, that's not so much what I'm supposed to do. But you could tell they really wanted it. How like us that is. We throw ourselves out of paradise by rejecting God's offer of life and friendship. We don't want to get too close to God because it's scary. We don't want to be dependent upon Him. We don't like even being interdependent upon each other. I mean, that's not true of everybody here in this room, but there are some people in this room who just the thought of asking help from other people, you resist that. You don't want to be dependent upon someone else. But the truth is, we are. We're dependent. We're dependent upon God. We're dependent upon each other. And we are, in fact, dependent upon the earth. So outside of paradise, we're estranged from God. We're estranged from ourselves. We become strangers to ourselves. And we also are estranged from others. And they become strangers to us. The very people that God says, you're just like them. You're one of us. And we get angry at them and we get fearful of them. And it all comes back to this little story. Because we threw off the limits that God had placed upon us. But in that story, God gives a promise. He says, there is going to come a day when one of your offspring is going to reveal the lie that is embedded in this little story. One of your descendants will overcome temptation and defeat the tempter. Redemption and reconciliation will be won, and the children of the earth will once again be the children of God. Friends of God. What does God want? He wants friendship. Genesis 4 through 11 tells the story of the pattern of God's self-offering and people's rejection of that union. Through the story of Cain and Abel and Noah and the flood and the Tower of Babel, people are always trying to make it on their own, to solve their own problems, to be like God. And we continue to do that. We do it with political and military alliances. We do it with economic policies and social oppression. Our desire for cooperation ends in competition. Our aspiration for unity, in fact, leads to disunity. Our efforts for success results in failure. And that's because we follow the way of the world rather than the way of God. Only God's way can come to rescue. Only by walking in His way can we defeat death. At the end of Genesis chapter 11 and the beginning of Genesis 12, things change. God's plan for redemption begins to unfold, and He does it by telling the story of Abraham. God reaches out to Abraham and grabs a hold of him and said, I want you to go to the place that I'm going to show you. And leave your family, leave everything else behind. Leave all the gods that you've been worshiping on that side of the Euphrates behind, and you go to the place that I'm going to show you. And what's going to happen is, even though the people who built the Tower of Babel did it because they wanted to have a great name, I'm going to make your name great. I'm going to make you the father of many nations. I'm going to bless you, and through you, I am going to bless a couple of the families on earth. Oh, is that what it says? No, what does it say? All the families. Oh no. All? How many is all? All. Through you, Abraham. All y'all. There you go. Do they speak that way in Florida? Oh, no, they don't speak in Florida. They just kind of grunt. So, Abraham, who was not an Israelite, he was not a Jew, although he was the first one that was called a Hebrew. He wasn't a Christian. He never went to temple. He never went to church. What does the Bible say about Abraham? He believed God, and God counted it to him as righteousness. That's one thing. And the second thing, and this is the only one who's called a friend, he's called the friend of God. What does God want? He wants friendship. He wants us to be friends. Even as Doug and I should pick you out, Doug. Even as Doug and I are friends, even as Alan and I are friends, God wants to be friends with God. Even as Steve and I are friends, God wants to be friends with us. Right now, part of what you should be hearing is a message that says, God is talking to you, and He's saying to you, I want to be your friend, and I want you to be my friend. Now, the people who are aghast at that want to keep God out there. Well, God is out there, and He's transcendent, but He is also immanent. And the big story says that God is going about the business of creating that friendship. The story of God's people, beginning with Abraham, is the story of God offering Himself again and again and again, and people rejecting Him, and God continuing to offer Himself to them again and again and again. Again and again and again. The so-called heroes of the faith are not heroes at all. They are broken, fallen people just like you and me. Whatever thing you suffer from, if you're a liar, Abraham was a liar. If you're a cheat, Jacob was a cheat. If you've committed adultery, David committed adultery. These are all people that we lift up as heroes of the faith. They are not the heroes of the story. God is the hero of this story. And he's a hero because even though we are faithless, he remains faithful. And that's what this story tells us about. So the story of Genesis to Abraham to Joseph is a story of abandonment and fulfillment and of how God is faithful to his promises whenever people trust in him and even when they don't. So Genesis has a happy ending, actually. It's not so happy in Exodus, which we pick up next week. But not all stories have happy endings. What about the people who seek to be faithful to God over and over again, and yet their lives are miserable? So we have the story of Job. Not a story of a real person who really existed, but a poem, an epic poem, a drama in which the stage is set, in which Satan, the character who is the adversary to Job, the protagonist, and says, of course he's good. Of course he's faithful. He has everything. He has a great family. He has great homes. He has lots of money. He has great standing. If you took all that away from him, would he still be faithful? And so God says to the adversary, Satan, you can have your way with him, but there are limits. And so the story is told. Everything gets taken away. His family gets taken away. His goods get taken away. His health gets taken away. His wife at one point says, just curse God and die. He has three friends that come to him and tell him, here's the reason why you're suffering this kind of anguish. It's because there's secret sin in your life. And Job is saying, there's no secret sin in my life. They give every pietistic answer there is as to why he's suffering, and every single one of them is wrong. And yet we quote Job's friends on a regular basis and say, it's in the Bible, we should believe it. The whole point of the story is, don't believe it. Finally, Job has an encounter with God, in which God says to Job, look it, you don't understand. You don't understand creation. You don't understand the complexity of the universe. You don't understand what's behind earthquakes and hurricanes. You don't understand what's behind the animals. You don't understand any of that. It's all too complex for you. Stop trying to figure it out. I am God. I know what's going on. You can trust me. And finally, at the end of Job, Job says, you know, I've heard about you from others, but now I've seen you face to face. And that's sufficient. God's answer to suffering is not to solve the mystery, which is what we want. Because we want to be like God. We want to know good and evil. We want to understand it all. God says to Job, you can't understand it all. And so Job lays down his life before the Lord. He says, I'm yours and you're mine. You're my redeemer. You're what I need. What does Job get? He gets friendship. What does God get from Job at the end? Friendship. That's what God wants. Fast forward to the big story in the New Testament. We're going to talk about it later, but what does Jesus say? Greater love has no man than this, than he lay down his life for his friends. And then he says to his disciples, you are my. That's pretty limp, folks. You are my friends. That's what God wants. That's why Jesus came, to reestablish friendship. Now, friendship comes at a cost. Friendship means I risk betrayal. That's what happened to Jesus. Friendship means I risk abandonment. That's what happened to Jesus. Friendship means I risk sacrifice. That's what Jesus did.